Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. You've probably noticed I always like to talk about nature on these shows. Have you seen any birds showing up for you lately? Well, out where we live near Bozeman Pass, I've been seeing our resident nuthatches, chickadees, Clark's nutcrackers, woodpeckers, and flickers. And this week, we also saw rosy finches and goldfinches. And we had some clear skies at night this week. Did you get to see any of the Geminid meteors? This morning, I woke up to a sky the color of a fire opal. I just hope you're looking up too. Our episode of Desert Oracle Radio today was produced by Ken Lane on November 10th, 2023, and it's about someone that was documenting the desert and its history long before he was. Enjoy.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. The night coming on very early now. We try to catch an hour or two of sunshine before it's gone again, because this is the time of the year we run to the sun and not from it. And if you cannot get outside till the last rays are scattering over the western mountains, so be it. If you are a desert walker, you know how to navigate after the sun goes down. You learn to do this in July and August, when it's not tolerable until the sun goes down. You learn to avoid those canyon corners and washes that get so shadowy and dark way too quickly. Too dark to make out the rattlesnakes all curled up on a patch of sand still warm from the long day. Many a nighttime drives to the distant all-night animal clinic have been caused by such lack of visibility in summertime. When the dog walks right onto the thing, rattlesnake avoidance training or not. So let me throw in a public service announcement here and mention that if you've got dogs and they wander the desert with you, even if it's only the acre behind your cabin, the rattlesnake vaccine costs about $30 a shot at the vet's office, which is about $1,170 less than a single vial of rattlesnake antivenom. And a big dog might need 4 or 5 vials of antivenom to survive a rattler bite. But once it got that $30 shot, ideally in the early springtime when the snakes come out again, which is when you should do it if you've got dogs, once a year, almost every kind of insurance is an evil scam dreamed up by the worst people alive. Even when the insurance is ultimately helpful in a situation, but $30, a one-time charge. No monthly billing, no automated rejection of life-saving surgery or medicines, etc. $30 is a good price. Now, where were we? Racing the sun. Trying to get away from the bad things into the good place while there's still some daylight or dusk light. one thing you get pretty good at if you're a desert walker is getting around long after the sun goes down. A half moon is helpful, a full moon sort of distracting with all the shadows it throws, but no moon or a new moon is fine too. I know where I'm going. But when it's cooler out on a night in autumn, the snakes are snuggled warm in their dens. Catclaw is your only real enemy on such darkened strolls. Speaking of Catclaw, which is officially called... who cares? The heavy summer rains have been very kind to the aspirations of that interesting thorny bush or tree or whatever it is. You know how they start. And these days are coming out of everything. Every crack in the pavement, one long stick with a handful of little green leaves and the special hooked thorns. Left alone for a half dozen years, it becomes a big clump of long woody branches that is just beautiful when it blooms with red or yellow flowers. The hummingbirds just love them. Left alone for a couple of decades, it becomes a tree, often hosting clumps of desert mistletoe, the Christmastime delight. Favorite food of the wonderful songbird called the Phainopepla. Its fantastic crest standing tall like Joe Strummer's Travis Bickle mohawk. You can make hunting bows from catclaw branches. People have been doing it for thousands of years. A good, strong, flexible wood. Just make sure to cut off the thorns. I've seen strange things this autumn in the desert. Double the annual rainfall will do that, especially when that rain comes in the warm, warm summertime. Just the other day, I came across a 4-foot-tall single sunflower, half-bloomed, on a desert mountain ridge about 4,000 feet in elevation. What are you doing here, friend? And big sorghum plants with leaves like corn stalks full of bushy grain on top. Those are coming up around me. A century ago, people planted this African grain in the Mojave here and there. They ain't try anything. Some people call it broom grass now. And I've never seen it come up like this, not before the hurricane. And it's a lot better than the devil's bumper crop of goathead now injuring humans and other animals throughout the desert lands. Speaking of birds, at some point we were speaking of birds. I saw somewhere that the bird professionals, the bird fanatics, have renamed a bunch of birds and put out a new official bird book with the new names and are now yelling at regular people regarding the use of these made-up new bird names. Well, here's an idea. Stop doing that. Do something useful like restoring habitat for songbirds and other wildlife. If you're sitting around on a Zoom conference under fluorescent lights in some office building or university or whatever, and your job is implementing the committee's changing of the bird names, just walk out. Don't say goodbye. Use the common names for things, and you'll find that people tend to know what you're talking about, and also they won't shun you quite so much. Language is ever-changing, of course, but as the French government has learned after centuries of creating official new French names for various internationally known objects and concepts, such as the computer mouse and esports, it just doesn't work. The new French term for esports, itself a ridiculous phrase meaning sitting on your backside playing video games, is jeu vidéo de compétition. Meanwhile, the words sport and électronique are already French words. But are beautiful mongrel tongue, the English language, chaotic and dynamic, has never had an official academic police department. Which is why Shakespeare, in the same period that France started policing French, was able to adapt and adopt and just plain invent the words and phrases necessary for his art to make his plays and poems come alive. And the primary reason English is such a rich use-what-works language today can in large part be traced to the Norman conquest of England in 1066. That's when the old Anglo-Saxon tongue began to adopt and adapt some 10,000 words from the old French and various parts of hand-me-down Latin. Depending on the linguists making the claim, anywhere from half to two-thirds of English vocabulary is French, or Anglo-Norman, or Norman Picard in its origin. So here are some words and phrases William Shakespeare either wrote down for the first time or invented. Alligator from Romeo and Juliet. Skim milk from Henry IV, Part 1. Rant from Hamlet. Traditional from Richard III. Worthless from Two Gentlemen of Verona. Undress from Taming of the Shrew. And obscene from Love's Labor's Lost. Even puppy dog, that comes from King John, and there are many hundreds more. Depending on your view of what counts as a word, or a new word, or a new phrase, or etc., the fact is, these are things we say today, and before Will Shakespeare became a popular playwright, they were at least unknown in writing and theater. Did you know that every single little American town and most American neighborhoods used to have a nice, locally owned, going-out restaurant, often a steakhouse, but always a place with a semi-detached cocktail lounge with a piano player? Maybe a small combo on weekends? Yucca Valley used to have a place like that from the 1950s to when the Great Regression began around 1980. I don't know when exactly the Glen made the transition to Reflections, the most 1980s name of anything ever, and then came the who knows years when everything began to noticeably decline on a community level. Let us remember the Glen. And I thank my friends Ryan and Dave for sending me this fantastic historical artifact some months or years ago. The Glen Coffee Shop and Cocktail Lounge, and there's a photo on this flyer, a picture that reveals this same location was later home to such mostly forgotten institutions as the Rib Company, Gotti's, and most recently something called the Awe Bar. Not all. Awe, like what you're supposed to feel when having a direct encounter with a god, a deity. And that wasn't their vibe, as they say. On the flyer it says, Duke Cornish on the organ. How often? 6 nights a week, 7 nights a week during the glory days in Yucca Valley. Can you even imagine such a thing? And this was a local restaurant for locals. The prices were affordable. Weekly splurge for regular folks, a nightly hangout for the real estate agents, the confidence men. But you could take the family out for breakfast after church, as most middle-class people in Yucca Valley remember doing. And you could take the mistress there for a whiskey sour and some Oysters Rockefeller on Saturday night, before church, you know? Maybe Duke Cornish will play That's Life like he does every night on that hot organ. Been a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn, and a king, up and down and over and out, etc., etc., back in the race. And after that, maybe the Duke will play something slow and romantic. One for my baby and one for the road. No, that's not right. Not for tonight. How about witchcraft? That might just do the trick, or Everybody Loves Somebody Sometimes. the whole back parking lot of the Glen was like the submarine races. Come 2 a.m, and more than a few drove right into that giant flood-controlled ditch instead of successfully putting it into reverse. Many problems in the morning. Miss Beverly had to make up a pretty good excuse and put on some extra foundation to cover the many minor injuries she suffered from the broken windshield glass. Mr. Bradley had to call in a few favors to keep his job at the school district. Lunches, dinners, cocktails, breakfast served all day. Your hosts, Scotty and Margot Gillanders, in the heart emoji of town, Yucca Valley, phone 365-9910. The matchbook says the Glen is the High Desert's newest and finest restaurant and cocktail lounge, air-conditioned, banquet room available. 56193 29 Palms Highway, food served 6 a.m. till 9 p.m. Lounge open 9 a.m. till 2 a.m. nightly. You can see the newspaper racks outside. You get your paper on the way in. The sports final. Put that on my ticket, will you, Jody? Used all my dimes at the bowling alley last night. Scottish stuff was in vogue then, like the wonderful old Tam O'Shanter in Atwater Village, designed and built by the legendary Desert Rat scrapbook publisher and architect. From the World War II years to 1965, the artist and humorist and hugely influential architect Harry Oliver published his Desert Rat scrapbook. He called it a pocket-sized newspaper covering the Great Southwest. And if you're saying so, that's where the idea for Desert Oracle came from, you'd be wrong. I'd never heard of Harry Oliver's Desert Rat scrapbook until the second issue of Desert Oracle, which I was dropping off to sell at the old Sagebrush Press bookstore in Yucca Valley back in the spring of 2015. And the bookshop's owner, Dan Cronkite, showed me a couple of vintage copies he had from the 1940s and 50s. They're not bound like a book or magazine, but folded down from one large sheet of colored cardstock and printed on both sides, with all kinds of cornball cartoons of burros and jackrabbits, and beautifully made woodcut titles, and the claim that it was the only newspaper you could open in the wind, and the deserts are notoriously windy. Well, I ended up trading a stack of new Desert Oracles for a much thinner stack of Desert Rat scrapbooks, and that's when I began the hunt for Harry Oliver's biography, which only exists, as far as I know, in a handful of old homemade webpages and even older newspaper clippings. So let this serve as an appetizer, like you might get at the Glen at the beginning of another wild weekend in Yucca Valley. Harry Oliver grew up like Tom Sawyer, like Tom Sawyer's creator Sam Clemens, in a little Mississippi River town, Hastings, Minnesota, born in 1888. By the turn of the century, he had left school before completing fourth grade and was working in a print shop, setting type. He made posters, he printed newspapers, and he took the first of many jobs with a circus. As a young man, he followed his family to Santa Cruz, California, where they owned a chicken farm, and Harry rode a donkey for the U.S. Forest Service. Having the showbiz bug, he also worked for local theaters as a scenic artist. When a movie company came to town to shoot some exteriors, he got himself a job and went back to the new boomtown of Hollywood, where he became an influential set director, creating the look of influential films, including the 1920s and 1930s black and white original versions of Ben-Hur, Scarface. He worked on Viva Villa, Mark of the Vampire, Street Angels, Seventh Heaven. And his sets had a tremendous impact on the new German Expressionist movement. By the middle 1930s, he had retired from the grind of movie making and was building his sets as real-life storybook buildings, like the famous Witch House of Beverly Hills, and his series of beautiful adobe houses he called home, including his old Fort Oliver and today's Thousand Palms, not far from the Coachella Valley Wildlife Refuge and 20 miles due south of Joshua Tree, as the vulture flies. He was still putting out occasional Desert Rat scrapbooks when he was pushing 80 years old, and he passed away in California back in 1973. And it turns out the UFO writer, Greg Bishop, also the author of Weird California and Project Beta, pitched me a story on Harry Oliver, so I thought I should get him on the line 7 years later. Now I've just got to get his piece published and an upcoming issue of Desert Oracle. I sure wish I had my own printing press, like Harry Oliver did. This is Desert Oracle Radio, and I've been meaning to talk about Harry Oliver on this show pretty much from the beginning, going back 7 years now. And at one point, the author Greg Bishop wanted to do an article for the periodical, also called Desert Oracle. And I have such a hard time getting that magazine out. The endless search for a printing house that won't bankrupt me, etc., the postage doubling. So like a lot of ideas, it never materialized. But I've got him on the line here, and I want to ask a couple of questions about this endearing desert hermit, Harry Oliver. Greg Bishop, welcome to Desert Oracle Radio.
Thank you, and finally.
There was an accident this week that reminded me that you know a lot of stuff about Harry Oliver. Tell me how that happened.
I'm just interested in desert stuff. Of course, I was reading the Desert Oracle when it first came out, and subsequently. But because of that, and I don't know where I found it, it must have been in a bookstore or maybe online, I found a copy of something called the Desert Rat Scrapbook. It was written, edited, typeset, and printed, I believe, by Harry Oliver, who was a desert eccentric, or at least he grew into a desert eccentric. He was not originally from the desert, like most people in the desert, right? Especially out here. The Desert Rat Scrapbook was, it wasn't even grandpa humor, it was just very unique to Harry Oliver. He told tall tales. He told stories of desert people like Death Valley Scotty. The thing was the size of a digest, and it just has a nice woodcut illustration, usually on the front. The bottom of it always says the only newspaper you can open in the wind.
Yes.
Because it was printed on this hard, kind of like heavy stock. But you would unfold it, and it ended up being like this huge paper, but it's just folded down in this tiny little digest so he could mail it out.
Which he also did himself, right?
Every single bit of the production of that, of Desert Rat Scrapbook, was done by Harry Oliver, as far as I can tell. Even the printing, I think he had a printing press. He would typeset it in one of his many places he lived in. Well, many, I think I know of two. He lived in Borrego Springs for a while, where he helped establish the Peg Leg Smith Liars Contest. He lived in Thousand Palms, which is near Palm Springs. He built all his houses by himself out of adobe bricks that he made.
That's right, Old Fort Oliver, and that was on what is today Ramon Road.
I've read many times that it's just covered over with a mini mart or a gas station or something like that. Which is horrible, because I think his ashes were either scattered or buried there. I think some of them were stuffed in one of the adobe walls by one of his daughters because he asked her to do it.
Oh, so now that's probably under the $6 a gallon unleaded pump.
Yep, that's where Harry's ashes went. His first house I know of, when he was working for the film studios in the 20s, the teens and 20s, he was an art director. I think he was nominated for an Academy Award when they started giving them, but he didn't win. He built himself an adobe house in probably 1912 or something along Bayona Creek or Bologna Creek in Culver City. That is gone now too, but there's a warehouse or something there now. But he had a house there when he worked I think it was Willat Studios, and he might have worked for Roach, but I'm not Hal Roach, but I'm not sure. And he also, while he was doing this, he invented a architectural style that people call storybook, which was basically borrowed by Knott's Berry Farm, which he helped found, or at least promote, and Disneyland. Yeah, I think Disney actually cited Harry Oliver as a very important influence on the architecture of Disneyland.
You gave a talk up here in the high desert about Harry Oliver. When was that, and how did that come about, and what was the gist of your talk?
I think it was about 10 years ago. And my friend Barbara Harris and also Jane Poyawa, they were both involved with the Morongo Basin Historical Society, and they needed somebody to come out and talk about some desert stuff. And I said, I want to write about Harry Oliver. I need a reason to go look for information on Harry Oliver. I went down to the LA Public Library, picked up articles and the very few books by him. They had a couple copies there. And I even went all the way out to the 29 Palms Public Library because they had one rare book that nobody else had. And then the talk was about an hour long, and I had slides with it, of course. And after the talk, the Historical Society said they wanted a copy of my notes so they could keep it in their files, which was great. It's the only talk I ever did besides Weird California stuff that wasn't about UFOs.
You were one of the very few writers who has been fixated on UFO mysterious stuff and desert real history, architecture, that kind of thing. You don't see a lot of crossover.
No, not really. I've spoken probably 50 or 60 places on UFOs, about 10 on Weird California, and one on Harry Oliver.
One on Harry Oliver. That's, you know, he's such a singular character that almost has to be how it is. From Amboy to Zyzix and across the great Mojave Wilderness, this is Desert Oracle Radio with musical soundscapes on the program by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. And I'm your host, Ken Lane. There will be two more Desert Oracle live events in the year 20 and 23, both in Los Angeles, one after another, but otherwise entirely different shows. Coming up first on Friday, December 1st, I'm the opening act for the legendary sub-pop band Earth on the 30th anniversary of their heavy music classic record, Earth 2. At the Alex Theater in Glendale, tickets on sale now. On the following night, Saturday, December 2, it's the Desert Oracle Radio Holiday Show at Cafe Zebulon in, I call it Silver Lake. I guess it's officially Frogtown River Village or whatever. Names change. We are going to have an old-fashioned Christmastime program with musical guests, weird holiday stories, all recorded for broadcast. This is the early show, 7 to 9 p.m. at Zebulon, just under the 5 downhill from the Astro Diner. And I see here in the radio email, there's a note from the station asking me to do a new promo spot for Z107.7. Let's just do it right now while I'm here. It's just a regular small town with the regular features. A temple to the space monsters, a national park where the tourists tend to vanish, nightly choruses of coyotes. That's our Mojave High Desert, more or less. Friday nights at 10 p.m. on KCDZ 107.7 FM.
Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
That's what you call workplace efficiency. Thank you for tuning in tonight to Desert Oracle Radio. Enjoy these cool autumn nights. Thanks for listening. And good night from the voice of the desert.
Well, we are at the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio. Well, winter solstice is coming up on Thursday, December 21st at 8:27 p.m. Mountain Time, smack in the middle of the KGVM Christmas movie night. Die Hard will be the film, and that event starts at 7 p.m. Admission is free. Popcorn is $5 to help support the station. The Labor Temple at 422 East Mendenhall in Bozeman is the place. Yeah, I tried to find out if there was an author on par with Harry Oliver that documented the land and lore of the Gallatin Valley or even Montana. I know that there was someone out in Yellowstone Park that did some guides, and we'll probably talk about that person down the road. But as far as our local history, the Gallatin History Museum has kind of taken on the role of preserver for much of the history of our place. Today, you can hear more of the recording I did there with my guide, Marlene. These stories give us a glimpse into some hard times before Bozeman had places of help like Haven, Family Promise, the Warming Center, HRDC, or the Fork and Spoon Cafe.
We are now in the isolation cells. And there were four isolation cells. They called this Siberia.
Ooh.
And it is truly, if you thought the underground tunnel was scary, this one is even more creepy. We did have a person who did paranormal testing, and the two places in the jail that they did find paranormal activity was here in the isolation cells and in the tunnel. So, so you can see what the cells look like. This would have been for unruly, maybe violent inmates that either posed a danger to themselves or others, and also for someone who's on death watch. Like poor Seth Danner. He was here 2 weeks before he actually got hung.
What a wretched place to
spend. What a horrible place to be.
2 weeks of your life.
Yes. It's very dark. Just, you can see, you don't really have any contact. You can see there's not really, you can maybe talk to the people across the way. That's bricked up, but it wasn't.
Oh, okay.
But you can see there's metal, solid walls, so you really don't have connection with the people next to you.
Yeah, it's like, just like, oh, what do you call that, bolted together tin box, or not tin,
yeah.
Steel.
Yeah.
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 Wow.
Yeah.
Even the floor.
Yeah. There's nothing.
And the ceiling has bars on it, too.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Going back up the stairs.
The bathrooms are where there were padded cells.
Oh.
But obviously, being a public area, we have restrooms.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to take you. Let's go. We're up on the second floor. I just showed her where the women's cells were. And now we've stepped into an area that was the infirmary. And so they had an infirmary for the inmates. And we've got some new displays in here. And going over next door, this is the music room. But this room here was the juvenile room. And so the juveniles were removed from the rest of the inmates and had their own little room where they would be. So if there was overcrowding, which obviously in the end there was, or they wouldn't have moved, They would use the women's and the juvenile cells to put men in. If they had to. Not with the women or the men in them, obviously. Yeah. Because we didn't really have that many women or juveniles, you know.
Okay.
People ask me, what would cause a woman to be arrested in, you know, the early 1900s? Probably indecent behavior. We did have a red light district and drunken disorderliness, Calamity Jane and a few others, you know, would get a little too drunk and, you know, raucous and start swearing if they got out of control, they could end up.
Did Calamity Jane ever spend
I don't any believe time she here? Spent she spent time in the poorhouse in Bozeman. And she was very sick. She was an alcoholic, and she was very sick, and she got taken there, and she was furious when she finally woke up.
So was the poorhouse like a detox center?
The poorhouse was for people who, they didn't have welfare, so people who were just didn't have any means to take care of themselves. Would go there and they'd work, you know, for their room and board. And this was during a period in the 1880s and a little bit further on when mining was kind of having difficulties. And so a lot of the miner families, you know, would just be homeless and the kids and all would go. And this was located kind of where the MSU farm is.
Oh, okay.
And that's where the poorhouse was.
All right.
Yeah. So I've got the lights off in here, but this is so that's kind of it on the jail.
Okay.
I think I'll go back and we'll talk about Seth Danner now.
All right.
So in 1920, Seth Danner and his wife, Iva Danner, who was younger, and their children came to Montana traveling with this other couple who were friends of theirs, John and Florence Sprouse. They are camping along the Gallatin River at a place called Central Park. They are not on vacation. They are destitute. They came from Kansas. They are just surviving. They are camping. The children have no shoes. There's snow on the ground. And the men are going out during the day. They've got trap lines. They're fishing. They're hunting. And they're doing what they can to survive, little odd jobs here and there. Well, one night, Florence asks him, it's getting dark, where is my husband? They went out together and only he came back. And he says, I don't know. We split and he hasn't come back. And as it's getting darker, she is getting louder and louder and louder. Well, the Sprouses just kind of disappeared. No one really heard any more about them because they weren't from here and they didn't have kids. And no one reported them missing. But this family, the Danners, moved to Three Forks, Montana, which is in Gallatin County. And he, you know, is renting a little house. He's doing odd jobs in both Bozeman and mostly automotive type work and Three Forks. And he is distributing moonshine. So he has gotten picked up at least once by the police for distributing moonshine, but nothing violent. 2.5 years go by, and his wife, Iva, comes into the sheriff, and she says, I'd like to report a couple of murders. Oh, yeah? Who? And she says, the Sprouses. When did this happen? 2.5 years ago. And why did you wait this long to come and tell me? Because my husband threatened me. My husband killed him, and, you know, he threatened me if I said anything. Okay. Can you show me where the bodies are buried? And she could. She took them right to where the bodies, wow. It was kind of a marshy area along the river, and the bodies are totally decomposed by this time, and they bring them up. And of course, at that point, they bring Seth in. Seth, of course, says, I didn't do it. And, oh yeah? Your wife said you did. Well, she's just trying to get rid of me because she's got another man, is what he said. Actually, she's kind of the reason they died. Okay, what's your side of the story? Well, he says, well, she was having an affair with John Sprouse, and they're, you know, having a little rendezvous in the bushes. His wife finds him, and she's angry, goes back to the tent, picks up a pistol, and she shoots her husband. Then she's kind of trying to decide what she's going to do with Iva, and Iva realizes she's in trouble, and she picks up the axe that's in the camp, and she throws it and hits Florence in the head.
Who threw the axe?
Iva.
In self-defense?
In Seth Danner's wife.
Okay.
And so both Sprouses are dead. Okay. Her version was that he killed John Sprouse to rob him. These are two destitute families.
Yeah.
To rob him.
Yeah.
And when Florence starts to yell as it's getting darker and darker, he tells her to shut up, and she doesn't. So he picks up an axe, and he throws it at her head, and she's not quite dead, so he takes a little piece of leather string, and he chokes her. We'll never know exactly which one was right. Well, in 1923, I don't believe that they thought women could do terrible things. And so they did hold Iva in a cell for, you know, interrogation, but they let her loose with the agreement that she would testify against her husband, which she did. She testified against her husband, and he was convicted. And and the interesting thing was, soon as she is rid of him, she does run off with another man. She takes their kids and she puts them in the state orphanage, which is in Twin Bridges, and she never comes back.
Wow.
Now, I met a great-grandson last January, and I asked him, did you guys ever hear from your great-grandma again? Did the rest of the family know where she went? He said no. No, she just disappeared.
Wow. And these were her kids?
These were her kids.
Wow. Yeah.
One boy, when he got to be a teenager, ran away from the orphanage and actually did pretty well. This was the father or the grandfather of the young man that I talked to. The other one was in and out, didn't do well. The younger son was in and out of jail and didn't do well. Mm-hmm. These were her kids.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And so, what else? So we will never know. We have a book written here, Murder on the Yellowstone Trail, which is about the execution of Seth Danner and the whole story. This was written by one of our ex-curators, Kelly Suzanne Hartman, who's no longer working here, but I did go on a tour with her once, and you could tell her bent and the book's bent is she believes Iva was responsible for the murders. Mm-hmm. If you asked me, I don't know. That's what I say. I don't know, but I kind of almost think they both were somewhat responsible. I think he was kind of helping her and kind of at least cleaning up what she did.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Because they both knew where the bodies were buried.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, my.
So, anyway, that's our one and only hanging, official hanging, because we've had some self-hangings in cells, but this is the only hanging here. And it was private. You know, it had witnesses, a priest and other people. They actually had a curtain around them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't a it wasn't a public spectacle.
Right. Right. Wow.
But I've read books that claim that, you know, this was one of the most grisly murders in Montana, and that, definitely earlier books claimed that he did it, and he was convicted. But if you look in this little alleyway we have here,
mm-hmm.
I call this the Alley of Gossip because in the 1920s, this was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
We had the crime, which we didn't know about originally, mm-hmm. and then we have the divorce trial, and of course everybody's following that. That's, mm-hmm. Gossip. We've got the murder trial and, of course, the execution. And so we've got a whole bunch of newspaper articles about it. And I've read enough to know that, people kind of prejudged him ahead of time. He was convicted of this crime in the public way before he ever was in the court. One article claims, of course he did it. He has some Cherokee blood in him, so he is a
brother.
Savage.
Oh, brother.
And so, So, anyway, you could and the book pretty much goes over these kind of articles, and that's about all she really had to. Anyway, he got along with the guards very well.
Mm-hmm.
He was religious, at least at the end. He was very religious.
Mm-hmm.
He had women coming and, praying with him. And like I mentioned before, he played his guitar every night.
Mm-hmm. Is his guitar still here?
I don't believe so. No, okay. I think they took the guitar. We do have a picture.
Yeah, I saw the picture out here.
He was quite a handsome man, I thought.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
How old was he when the crime happened?
You're going to have to get these things. It does tell you, but I have forgotten what that is. In his 30s. I believe.
Mm.
He wasn't that old. Mm. Maybe if I pick up the book, I can find out.
I'm just wondering because in the picture, this looks like a very young man.
Yeah, no, he wasn't very old.
Yeah.
No, and he
He lived a hard life. Mm-hmm. His uncle kind of took him in when he was young in Kansas. And like I think I told you on the phone, he lived with them. And then his uncle died. He marries his aunt, who was only a couple years older than him. They had a child, and then she died. And then he marries her daughter.
Ida. Yeah.
Yeah, her daughter. So, yeah.
Well, my thanks to Ken Lane and especially to Marlene at the Gallatin History Museum. The next couple of shows will be double features to give me more time to spend with my visiting family. I hope you will be building some lovely memories this season, too. I'll be back with the next regular show on January 7th, and that show will have a little more from the Gallatin History Museum. Happy solstice to you all. Thank you, Gallatin Valley and online listeners, for listening. As always, you can call me and leave a message or text about anything on your mind. Hey, I'm still open to gratitudes, too. The number is 1-406-404-6246. Remember to spread the word that you can hear this program on the air at 95.9 FM Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. Ryan Bingham is taking us out today with his song, The Poet. See you next week.
Long gone, out where the wind blows, a desert sky, she flies by for miles. As I keep walking, people keep talking about things they've never seen or done. Homeless sleep in the park, sweethearts kiss in the dark, I myself just move on through town. Moon keeps on shining and the ridge keep on dining, and all high, I love the highway song. Now to the back, poet writes his songs in blood. The coyotes are calling, the stars keep on falling, your mother, she won't be around. A feather blows down the road and the wind is cold and your wings are broken, your heart is living on the run. Lonely and wasted, her eyes replaced it, and I don't think I'll make another mile. Town to town I run, my horse ain't too drunk, the wind is singing to the sun. Now to the back, the poet writes a song in blood. The jukebox is barking, I'm just getting started. I've yet to see the light of day. Senoritas lose it to the mariachi music, 'cause New York's too far away. And the band keeps on playing with beer bottles breaking. The barmaid, I heard she pulled a gun. Oh, it takes a pistol, points it at this sister, says, honey, your day is done. Bow to the back, the poet writes his songs in blood. Bow to the back, the poet writes his songs in blood.